Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's audio conference training on building the practice of orientation offered by the Office on Violence Against Women in partnership with Praxis International. My name is Beth McNamara. We're going to do our usual quick housekeeping details, and then we're going to get started. So to let everyone know, we're recording today's session, and at the end of the three-part series, we'll make that available on our website in an online streaming way so that you can easily access it later. And our website is praxisinternational.org. At that very same place, you can find materials for today's call. We have an outline and a couple of handouts made available for you. So if you go onto our website and click our programs, visitation TA, and then on the left-hand side, you'll see some options for training. If you click on Praxis Events, and then once you're into that homepage, you'll be able to scroll down and see where the materials are posted. You have to scroll down just a little bit. So if it doesn't open up right away, scroll and you'll find it. If there's any materials or resources that we talk about in this session or the next two sessions, we'll make sure to post those at the end of the series and make those available for you. And we also would like to know that OVW supports the notion that grantees have access to technical assistance and training and support from a whole variety of organizations and people. This training is presented by Praxis, and while we're supported by OVW as a technical assistance provider for this grant, the points of view of this call are that of Praxis and not necessarily representing OVW. We try to stay in line with what OVW is putting out there, but we wanted to make sure that you know that we're not speaking on behalf of the office. We would also like to take the time to thank OVW for supporting all of these opportunities for us to come together on a regular basis over the phone and in person and give us this chance to explore new ideas, explore what people are thinking, and just have a chance to think out loud together. So today, as a part of our exploration, we're going to explore the practice of orientation. So for the last couple of years, Praxis has taken on this endeavor to really start looking at the first appointments that visitation centers are doing with people and the way in which people have been welcomed into centers. And so through that exploration of a couple of years, what we have found out is that when people come to a visitation center, they're just drawn into this life-altering process that is confusing, it can be really complicated, it can be really intense, and it can be really unfamiliar. And so what we know is these first appointments that we have with people, it can influence everything that happens in the visitation center and what happens post-separation from that point forward. And so that's why we really wanted to spend some concerted time in thinking about it and critically examining how we can think about this in another way. And what we mean by that is that we're thinking of orientation in a little bit different way than how centers have, not all centers, but some centers have moved through a process of having these first appointments before visits start, before exchanges start, to have people come in for what typically has been called an intake. And how we're reframing it, or how we're now thinking about it, is that we're feeling like intake was really center-driven. So when we had lots of opportunities to talk about, tell me all the ways and all the things that you need to do and need to accomplish before you can set up your first visit with somebody, there's a whole list. People, centers can give you a whole list. I can give you a whole list of like just stuff we have to get done before visits start, before exchanges start. And what we found is that really what that means is then you spend those first appointments, that first appointment or the next couple of appointments sometimes, getting that stuff done. And it becomes all about what the center needs. And while we don't want to kind of ignore or abandon the importance, we all have to fill out our semi-annual report every 6 months. That doesn't go away. We have lots of other obligations. And then there's just things that we need to know. There's a chance that we need to get somebody's phone number so we can contact them. We need to know medical information, emergency contacts, all those things. It doesn't go away, and we don't want to lose sight of the fact that those can't go away. But what we're really wanting to reframe is that these first moments that you have with people, this first appointment, moves away from a center-driven practice that can happen so easily. I think when from my experience, from a lot of times working in other social service programs, that it happens just with a blink of an eye, without even recognizing it, that all of a sudden we have a form that we need to fill out, and that's just how we do it, and we move forward like that. So what we're introducing is, let's move away from that for a little while with people and move to a person-centered approach, and build in time for building relationships and conversation, and that stuff should come first, and then meet our administrative needs. So that's really what the shift in what we're thinking about. We're also thinking that orientation is such an important time because it sets our tone for how we move forward with people, with men, women, and children who come into our centers. It gives us this one first opportunity to set the tone and also to convey our philosophy around the work. You know, OBW has put out our guiding principles. That's the direction that we're headed and trying to convey, and this is where we can start inserting and following those guiding principles. So when we started really examining, dissecting, okay, what do we want to do? What do we want to propose for this orientation modules? We came up with these three purposes of orientation. And, you know, I think, as Ellen and I are talking, because there was, you know, a couple of years here of thinking out loud, that we hope we've got these three purposes really right, but we're not saying that this is the end-all, be-all, the only thing that we should accomplish during orientation. But this is our starting place, and we'll kind of move through that, and I'm sure at the end of this series or even at the end of today, we'll have this chance to all explore together and figure out if we've got this right or on the right track. But so the first one we're thinking is recognizing and meeting families' unique needs. And the second purpose we've identified for orientation is building respectful and fair relationships, and the third is building a foundation for safety. So as luck would have it, it fit very nicely with our design of our ACTs because there are also three parts. So by design, we've decided to take those three purposes and dedicate each of our three-part series to one of those. So today, we're going to dedicate our time to thinking about building a foundation for safety. And what I'm going to try to encourage you to do is really take this opportunity, this next 75 minutes that we have together, and be open to, you know, exploring how we've spent our time. Don't be too quick to do the yeah buts. I've been there many times. Yeah, but when am I going to do this? Or yeah, but I don't have that much time. Or yeah, but so catch yourself being open, and let's, you know, use our time to think about how this could work, think about how this might not work, and then let's work through the challenges. But don't be too quick to dismiss it. All right, today we have the honor and the privilege of having Dr. Ellen Pence on our call today, and she's going to help us critically think about it, challenge ourselves, explore it. We also have Bill Beadle and Jill Abernathy from the Duluth Visitation Center on our line today, who've graciously given us their time to do some role plays with us and be available to ask questions and bounce ideas off of. So they will come on the line in a little while with us. Also wanted to let you know in about 30 minutes, we're going to take an intentional time for a break, which means that we encourage you to ask questions. Doesn't mean that in 30 minutes is the only time you can ask questions. We're just going to take a little break and let the operator open everyone's line up to ask questions that they have. If you have a question that you want to be put in the question queue, push number one at any time, and then Stephanie can help you. She'll get on your line privately and give you instructions on how to know when your line is open so you can ask your question. We have muted everybody's line just like usual. We have a lot of people registered for our call today, which means that if we opened everybody's line up, people will have a really hard time hearing, and sound quality is poor. So that's one of our attempts to make sure that everybody can hear. Just a little technical piece that sometimes helps if you're having a hard time hearing and you're on speakerphone. Sometimes it's easier not to be on speakerphone and call in from a handset. And the other thing, you can push *4, and that enhances your volume on your handset. So without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Ellen, and she's going to get us started in exploring safety.
Okay, thank you, Beth. And you just stay in here, Beth, because when I get little, you can make little commentaries about what I'm saying here. When Beth started out, she said that while OVW pays for this, they don't necessarily agree with everything they say. And I noticed that when I get on these calls, sometimes I don't even agree with myself by the time it's over. You know, I think this whole field is shifting so fast that things that I thought 2 years ago, I don't necessarily think today. And I worked in the Duluth Visitation Center back in 1989, 1990, and that was like when the very first visitation centers were being opened that had anything to do with domestic violence. And then I just had kind of very, what we'd call like in and out contact with the visitation center. I would maybe volunteer on a Sunday afternoon for a few hours or do this or that. And so I went a long period of time without being very intimately involved. And then when Praxis applied to be the technical assistance provider for the Supervised Visitation Center program, I started going around to other parts of the country and visiting visitation centers and watching what they did. And I just had this idea that the way that we did visitation centers was the way they all got done. And so then I'd go here and I'd say, oh, look what they're doing there. And then I'd go over here and say, oh, my gosh, they're doing that there. And it was so different. There were some things that we were all doing alike, and there were just so many things that we were doing different that I realized that this thing called a supervised visitation center doesn't really look the same everywhere you go, and that none of us have kind of this 100% answer to all the problems that we face when we deal with these. But OVW really threw kind of a curve to all of us when it said, we want to fund visitation centers that specialize in protecting victims of battering and both adult and child victims. There were only a handful of visitation centers around the country that was their specialty. Everyone else, it was like, visitation centers were generic in the sense that that people came in from a lot of different places. And now all of a sudden to say, what are you going to do around domestic violence cases specifically? What's unique about these cases? How are you going to design your visitation center to take up, amongst all the other things you're doing, we want our money to go to figuring out how to do this safely for victims, adult and child victims of domestic violence. And you know, I think that pretty much people thought, yeah, well, what we're doing works. And then all of a sudden we started looking at what each other did. People came to the visitation center in Duluth, and here I thought we were, you know, doing quite well because nobody had ever gotten killed and nobody had ever gotten seriously injured. But all of a sudden I saw that there were a whole bunch of, like, gaping holes in some of our safety kind of features, et cetera, and that luck in some ways had gotten us where we were. I mean, there were a lot of good things we were doing, but we were also lucky to not have had a serious assault with some of the kind of the gaps that we had and some of the safety things we were doing. So I think that all of us, I always think of this as kind of like if you were a chemical dependency program and you just took in everybody had a drug or alcohol problem, and all of a sudden a funder came and said, we want you to work with women on meth who have children and we want the children to come with them to your chemical dependency program. What would you have to do different? Well, my gosh, you'd have to kind of understand things different. You'd have to deal with these kids all of a sudden. There'd be all these differences. So this orientation comes out of that whole three-year debate and discussion that went on amongst about 75 visitation centers about what do we have to do different because we're dealing with domestic violence. And so I want to talk about this in terms of safety now. I'm assuming, and I should never assume like this, I should have really asked Beth to send it out, but I'm assuming that many of you have seen the Power and Control Wheel. And the Power and Control Wheel is a description, not of domestic violence, but it's a description of living with someone who batters. The Power and Control Wheel has the word power and control in the middle, and then around it are all the tactics that batterers use to control their partners. Physical abuse, sexual abuse are on the rim outside this wheel, and then all inside the wheel are other tactics like emotional abuse and use of children, isolation, intimidation, coercion, these other significant tactics that batterers use as part of a pattern to dominate in their relationships. And the Power and Control Wheel has become, it's like been translated into like 40 different languages because it's hit kind of a universal chord with women who are being battered saying, yes, that's when you're being battered, this is all the stuff that's happening to you. So when someone comes to a visitation center and battering is the issue, it's very difficult to, an organization like a visitation center is trying to do different things, different ones of us. We're on a continuum. Some of us are just trying to have a service where for 2 hours every week nobody gets hurt. OVW is kind of pushing us to say, you know, when you're working with domestic violence cases, it's true that you want to make sure that for those 2 hours nothing gets said or done that's going to put somebody in jeopardy or make somebody harm someone. But battering, the process when, how am I going to put this? When, if any of you have ever lived with a batter, you work with somebody who's lived with a batter, or you can't just say to them one day, you know, Phil's on the other line here, you know, Phil, this just isn't really working out. I kind of think we should maybe separate, hon. And then Phil's going to say to me, oh, yes, dear, you're right. This isn't working out so good. How should we divide the property? That's not what's going to happen when you tell a batterer you're leaving him. When you tell a batterer you're leaving him, he's going to say in some way to you, you think you're leaving me? You think you're leaving me with, you know, just like that? You're just going to walk out the door or you're going to take our house? You think that's going to happen and I'm going to do nothing about it? Not a chance. So while these words might not get said, that's the message that almost all battered women get. You are not going to walk out of this relationship without some punishment. Now, if you try to think about what happens to put yourself in the place of a batterer, where much of your attention and much of your focus is on making this person on some level conform to the way you want them to be, how you want them to be in a relationship, how you want them to be as a mother, how you want your house to be, how you want her to be socially. So much of your energy is geared towards what you want her to be, and a lot of your behaviors towards her are shaping her to be what you want her to be. And now she tells you, I'm leaving. And as she walks out the door, for most batterers, this is a period of time of wait a minute. And once she leaves that relationship, either she gets a protection order and he's out the door, or she walks out the door and goes somewhere else, his ability to control her every day by knowing what she's doing, how she's doing it, being there with her, completely dissipates. And now he has to shift because he no longer has that immediate relationship and presence with her. He has to shift his tactics. And visitation centers are plopped right in the middle of a battering relationship during that shifting period. I always say that he moves from oftentimes the living room as his place of control to the courtroom as his place of control. And when he does that, he's now much more dependent on getting people like CPS and the criminal court and the civil court and legal entities to help him control her by threatening her with those things. Do you think any court is? Do you think a judge is going to give you custody of our kids? You're the one that's going to a psych. You know, you're the one that's been in a psych ward. You're the one that's going to a psychologist. You're the one that's on antidepressants, not me. Do you think any court's going to get? Where are you going to get the money to raise our kids? You think I'm going to give you money to raise our kids and you go off and live with someone else? I don't think so. And so all of these kind of threats to her, he's basically linking them to, do you think the courts are going to do this? Do you think these people are going to do this? They know you're nuts. They see you're nuts. They this, they this. And so women are coming out of that abusive relationship into many institutions where they're either seeking help or they're being put in for help with that message from him. And unfortunately, many of those institutions play perfectly into his threats by how it is that they then take her up as a client. And this has been the criticism, really, of visitation centers around the country, in that as visitation centers proclaimed a neutral stance between the men and the women, saying, we are here for the children, we're not here to get involved in the conflict between him and her, that plays exactly into the hands of a batterer. And so there's been a very, very, I'm not going to go into this all now, but there's a, if you want an article on this that we've just finished, and Beth can send it to you. It's an article on neutrality in visitation centers and how the concept of neutrality has been used by batterers to, in fact, put a stranglehold on her and to increase their power on her as she's left the relationship. So visitation centers have to think about not an incident that happened, he beat her up or he's beat her up several times, but a plan that he has for her and the children, a pattern that's gone on over time, but also what is it that he's now going to do because she's left. And so there is that two-hour period that you have total control of those kids and him. Sometimes she's actually the visiting parent, and so you're with her, the victim of this abuse, and the children. And when you're with either her and her children or you're with him and his children, you're in that two-hour period where your obligation is to make sure nothing dangerous happens then. So in orientation, you have to figure out what are all the things that could happen in that two-hour period that would harm someone. At the same time that you're in that, you're totally responsible for what goes on in that two-hour period, you're engaging with that family during what we might think of as the two-year period. And that's the 2 years from when she starts to make the move to leave him to when, and I don't want to say that a batter has ever totally accepted that she's left him, but for many batters, it takes almost 2 years for them to let go of that stranglehold around her, to quit threatening this and threatening that. Many go on way beyond 2 years. But for most battered women, that two-year period from when they walk out the door to when he finally lets go and backs off a little bit is very, very, it's a shifting form of abuse. It's very, very traumatizing. It's very damaging to her and her children. It's damaging to her economically, her ability to care for her children, her ability to house and feed and educate her children, all those basic kind of things that all of us as parents need is compromised severely during this period of time of separation when he is relentlessly letting her know that she did something horrible to him. Now, I hate to kind of make generalizations about batterers, but I can make one generalization that I think is fairly accurate, and that is that most batterers experience themselves as the victims of the people that they abuse. And so they see themselves, and this is not that they're just lying to you and making things up. They experience themselves as victims. They truly see, look what she did to me. She left our home. She left our family. She walked out. Yes, maybe I did some things that weren't right, but look what she's done. She's destroyed everything. She's taken my kids away from me. She's taken my house away from me. She's taken everything that we built towards away from me. He sees himself as a victim of her choice, as he sees it, to leave him, rather than the reality of the consequences of his violence, of his sexual abuse towards her, his physical abuse, all of the emotional, psychological abuse that goes with that. Rather than seeing that this is the natural outcome of that, he instead sees himself as a victim of that. Now, that is almost a universal kind of experience of not only batterers, but most people in powerful positions that use violence against others. That's the position that you would see a lot of white South Africaners in right now in South Africa. You know, this idea that we lost our country, that, you know, they don't see what it meant to enslave a people in their own homeland, take the land, take all the riches from that land, build up a wealth, and have the people from that land poor, use all that violence to do that, and then see the consequences of that when people finally get a vote and take back their country too, share the power, people feel themselves as victims of this process. This is true of every group of people that keeps another group down. They experience themselves as victims of the people they're keeping down, and that's true with batterers in general, and it's true with individual batterers. So it's important for visitation centers to recognize that, I keep wanting going back to this, why it was so unhelpful to think of ourselves as being neutral in this conflict, because when you're dealing with somebody who's using a lot of violence and using a lot of, let me just say this, that the way that batterers, a common element of battering is that if there's children involved in that relationship, that it would be very rare for a batterer to batter his wife, to physically and sexually dominate her through coercion, intimidation, and violence, and not use the children as a part of that battering. it's almost universal. And now it's not the same. It's not to the same level with every batterer. Some batterers are just absolutely horrific in the way that they will use children against their mothers. I was in Manchester, England a few years back, and I picked up the paper, and a little article in the left-hand corner of the second page, there was a little banner that said, "Man beats wife with baby." And I just thought, oh, my God. I mean, you know, it's what I've been working on for many, many years, but the actual physical image of this, of him, and when you read the article, he grabbed the baby by her feet, and he started beating her with the baby. And this is what it goes on in battering, is the children are used as a way of punishing her, of hurting her, of controlling her. If you think of isolation as a major tactic of batterers, batterers do not want women to have intimate relationships with their children because it's the most intimate relationship women have, and you don't let a person that you're battering have intimate relationships with anyone, not their mother, not their sister, not their best friend, and certainly not their children, because that intimacy with another person is what batterers can't let happen. That her major energy and the resources that she brings to that family have to be directed towards him. So, yes, he wants to do her to be the mother of those children and do things for them, but most batterers undermine the intimacy of the relationship and the authority, if I can use that word, that women have with their children, and the exclusiveness in some ways. That relationship a mother has with her child is a relationship that's in and of itself separate from him. Yes, he's a part of it. He has his own relationship with his children that she's not necessarily a part of. But for her to have this relationship with the children that he's not a part of is not very acceptable to most batterers. So when you're doing your intake, you're trying to figure out some basic things. What makes this visit possibly dangerous in these 2 hours? What makes this visit, what makes this this period of time of separation more dangerous? And how are the children and her relationship with the children and all of those things going to be a part of continuing the battering? And then the third thing is long term, how is it that these two people are ever going to be able to co or parallel parent these children? How can we be a part of, not the major part, but a part of putting them on a path where they're going to be able to both be in their children's lives in ways that that are not harmful to the children or to each other? And the orientation, then, is a way of, number one, bringing people into your center to say, this is what we're here for, is to help you. And secondly, to say, I need to know enough about what causes danger in your situation that we can guard against it and that we can engage with victims in protection and also engage with perpetrators in reducing both their opportunity to batter and also their inclination, their desire to. So I think that all domestic violence-related programs should have those two goals when they're working with abusers. Change their capacity, ability to batter by safeguards that you put in, but then also reach out to them in a way that really tries to get them to not want to do it so much, to change their inclination to batter. So the orientation session has to have kind of a dual purpose. One is to position you to do that by opening up a communication with him and a communication with her, and secondly, to position them to see you as possibly helping them. And that means that the way that the orientation has to be, or the very first contact, and in fact all contacts, is one in which you see yourself and they see you as partners. Partners towards a goal. Now, a lot of batterers don't have the same goal you have, so he might only see you as a partner towards part of his goal, which is to see his children more or whatever. He's not going to see you as a partner in getting his children back away from her, or a partner in you know, hurting her for leaving him, whatever. But he might see you as a partner in one part of his goal, which is to actually have a relationship with his children. With her, ultimately, programs, whether it's a mental health program, whether it's a domestic violence program, a visitation center, there should be an engagement with her that lets her know you found a resource in the community that is standing with you against violence and with your children. That's why this notion of neutrality has blocked many visitation centers from giving that messages to battered women. But at the same time, the visitation center has to say, we're here to do that with you. We're not neutral in the sense that we don't see a distinction between you and him, but we want to be fair and impartial towards him and you in this visitation aspect of your ongoing relationship. So we're here as fair, impartial people, but we're also here to stand with and to protect people against other people. There's someone there that's being violent, and there's someone there that's being violated. So visitation center orientations and intakes have to be thought of as positioning you, number one, to make the relationship that you need to do that with people, and number two, to give you the information that you need to. So having said that, it is now, I want to do just a little bit of a role play here, and I'm going to start out with you, Phil, and I'll come back and do another one with Jill later. But, Phil, I want to just act like you're coming in for the first time, okay?
Okay, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. And
okay.
I can't, obviously we don't have enough time to kind of, you know, if you're going to do a decent kind of orientation, you got to introduce yourself and say, let's say that we've introduced ourselves. I've already talked to you about what you want to get out of this hour, and I've told you what I need to get out of it, and I've talked to you about confidentiality and things like that. I've found out that Phil has been in prison for a manslaughter charge with a drunk driving, and he got out, and shortly after he got out, he moved back home, and within 3 weeks, she got a protection order against him, and he then came over to her house after she had a protection order against him and smashed up a vehicle of this guy that he thought was at her house. And he went back to jail for that. And now he hasn't seen his kids in 5 months. He's had these two stints in jail. And he's coming to visit his kids for the first time. Okay, Phil, is that a good background of you?
That's very accurate.
Okay. So, Phil, and so we're right in the middle of all this. What I want to do is I want to kind of talk about this idea of engaging with people in kind of a partnership, and at the same time, I'm trying to figure out just how dangerous is Phil. What about him is going to be dangerous for the center for those 2 hours, for her for those 2 years, and then I'm just trying to think, is there a way that I can start to engage with this guy over a long-term kind of way of being with his kids and her without anybody getting hurt? And I don't mean with them like in a household, but co or parallel parenting. So we're in the middle of our little conversation somewhere, and I'm just going to start talking to you a little bit, Phil. So, Phil, what when you think of you have there's Harry is 8 years old, right? Your son?
Yeah, that's right.
And Gracie's 3.
Yes.
What are you wanting to, you know, when you come and visit? What are your relationships like with both of them?
I have a great relationship with my kids, despite what, I don't know, Cheryl might tell you or might, you know, say. My relationship with my kids is great. My kids love me. And so I don't really think that, you know, that's really going to be too much of a problem for you at all, because I, you know, you can pretty much just stay out of our way, and my kids and I are fine together.
Okay. Now, do you know how the center works? I mean, has anybody explained this process to you yet or talked to you about it? Because when you're coming to visit your kids, you'll be in, you know, I took you through and you saw that bigger area, you'll be in there. And typically there might be one or two other families in that big area, and then there's that small kind of alcove off, and sometimes some of the families go over there and kind of claim that little space. But a lot of times people kind of get their little space and visit with their kids there, and there's a lot of different things to do. But did you see that set up, and does that seem like that will work for you?
It's fine. I mean, I don't need to be here. I mean, that's it. And you'll see. It's great that you have somebody watching, because you'll see that I don't need to be here. It's fine. My kids love me. I love my kids. There's absolutely no problem. It doesn't matter what you might have heard about me, but my kids love me, and so that's not going to be an issue. And you'll see it, and eventually, you know, the truth will come out.
Okay. And what are your long term kind of goals? Are you in the middle of a divorce situation now? What's the custody thing going on? Can you explain that to me a little bit?
Well, I'm sure you know. I mean, I got out of prison, and you know, this whole thing just completely changed my life. I was on this manslaughter charge. I was treated like a murderer, and you know, all I was doing was I got hit by a truck and I swerved out of the way and I hit somebody on a bike, and yeah, I had a couple of drinks. I wasn't drunk, but I had a couple of drinks and I was sent to prison. And so that completely changed my life. While I was in prison, my ex started screwing around on me, and then, you know, I got out and she turned the kids against me, and she was screwing around. There was different men in her house all the time, and so she took everything from me. But, you know, I'm not going to let her take the kids from me, and, you know, it's just a matter of time. I'll get an attorney, and the kids will be with me.
Mm-hmm. And how do you see that the kids will be with you?
Well,
you'd get custody of the kids, or what do you mean?
Yeah, I'll eventually, you know, I got to get my finances in order, but I'll get an attorney, and yeah, the kids, I'll have custody of the kids.
Okay. Now, can you just talk a little bit about when you're visiting the kids here, what things that you would like to do with them?
Well, I want to do the things that we've always done. We'll play games, and you know, if we can play catch. Harry loves to play catch. Gracie loves to read, so I'll read to her. You know, we'll do the things that a father is supposed to do with his kids. You know, hopefully, is it okay if I bring food? Can I bring food for them?
Mm-hmm. Okay, now let's just stop here. So I just want to explain something, that when I'm listening to Phil, I'm listening for how he describes, like now he's described, I am going to get those kids. I've got to get my finances in order. I'm going to get those kids. The truth will come out. So this is how I'm thinking as I'm listening to him. Okay, he's going, one of the things he's going to do is he's going to get into this custody fight with her. And so that means that the visitation center, if what I think I know about him is true, and I don't know that everything I know about him is true, but if what I think I know about him is true, then I'm looking for the possibility that the visitation center is going to be drawn into a battleground with him, where it's going to be used as a mechanism of trying to take his kids away from her. Now I just want to talk to her for a second. Beth, can I go on for another couple minutes?
Yeah.
Okay.
Keep going.
I just want to talk to her for a couple minutes. Phil, you're out. Jill, you're in.
Okay.
Okay. So Cheryl, can you describe a little bit about why it is that you asked to have the center?
Well, Phil's just gone crazy. He's always been like mean and controlling, but when he got out of jail, I'm telling you, he was crazy. He went after me. He pushed me. He held me up against the wall. He grabbed my hair and he said, "I'm not hitting you. I'm not hitting you. See, I'm not hitting you." I mean, it was crazy. And at one point,
why
Harry,
do you think he was saying that? "I'm not hitting you."
Well, because I had told him that if he didn't, you know, settle down, I was going to get an order for protection against him.
Oh, okay, so he equated hitting with if I.
I've never hit you.
Uh-huh, okay.
And you know, he really and truly, before he went to jail, he actually never had hit me.
Uh-huh.
But
he
always got
or?
His way, I'll tell you that. And uh-huh. He's been, I don't know if he's just obsessed the whole time he was in jail or what, but he's convinced that I'm sleeping around with guys, and that he's threatening continuously. He goes, "Nobody else is going to raise these kids. Nobody else is going to raise these kids." And I really don't know what he means by that, because, it's me. He's scary. He's been very scary. And like
and
I started.
This, like before he went to jail, was he ever very threatening to you, or mostly just when you say he was controlling but not threatening? He was never physical or?
No, but I think it was pretty much because he just had his way. I wasn't working. You know, I was at home and I took care of everything. And, you know, I just, it's more when I look back at it, I see how he just had everything his way, and he's always drank. And that's when he would get really mean, and I would stay out of his way. Well, now when he got home out of jail, just let him treat me this way. And so, you know, he says, get out of my face. And I say, well, you get out of the house because you're drunk, and it just gets crazy. And Harry got up out of bed. This was incident where I knew I had to get an order. And he came saying, you know, Dad, leave her alone. And he pushed Harry right out of the way to get to me. And, I mean, that's too much.
No.
I can take a lot, but this has just gone overboard. And I'm scared for the kids. And I will not have those kids alone with him because he's a drunk and he's a mean drunk. And he's going to ask.
Let me just ask you, if you think when you're scared for the kids, what do you imagine? I mean, like, what do you think might happen? Like, what are you imagining might be the danger that they're in?
Well, Gracie's only three, and he, you know, Gracie talks about him, but I think that's more because Harry does, because, you know, she was only two when he went into jail, but I don't think he'd be able to take care of her. I think that he could, well, number one, I'm scared to death he'd drive with them,
mm-hmm.
And also, well, you do know, I mean, you know that he killed somebody driving
mm-hmm.
drunk.
Yeah,
I mean,
he got a manslaughter charge. I mean, he was convicted of manslaughter. Uh-huh.
Yes, yeah, uh-huh.
Do you know the details of that situation? Okay, stop here now, Jill. Okay, so I want to just say that now I'm listening to Jill. I'm trying to get Jill's read on this. Now, I don't know how dangerous he is, and I'm trying to get Jill's read on it. Jill doesn't exactly know how dangerous he is. He's shifted since he came out of prison. I want to know more details about that, like what is he shifted doing? And then I want to get into Jill with, okay, so he's going to come here for 2 hours every week. Do you think you coming and going from here is going to be... number one goal I want to do is make sure that for these 2 hours you're safe. And then I need to know, like, during this time period now, what do you think is happening? So I'm trying to get from Jill... This notion of engaging with her is not one where you ask her a series of questions, but you're trying to get a picture from her. And the more you let her talk a little bit, the more she gives you a picture and you can zone in on, can you describe this a little bit more in this? Now, when she's getting down now to saying, well, the biggest thing I'm worried about is him being drunk with the kids. But now I want to go a little further saying, okay, that's a big thing, and that's one thing we can absolutely do. We can make sure that he is not going off with these kids drunk or anything. Now the next thing is are there other things you're afraid of? So partly I'm trying to engage with her in a conversation, and I'm engaging with Phil in a conversation with, if I let him talk long enough, I'm trying to get a sense of if he's battering her, and the way Jill is talking, I'm thinking that he's been engaged in a pattern of abuse, which has gotten significantly worse since the accident and then prison and jail. And everyone knows that prison and jail, men don't come out of prison and jail finding respect for women, you know. A lot of things happened there that has kind of shifted him into another gear, I think, of probably being abusive. So now this is trying to get a picture, but at the same time, I'm trying to do it in a way that Jill thinks and believes that I'm engaged with her. I'm not here as kind of a neutral bystander just to protect her kids, but I'm engaged with, can you explain this to me? Do you think this? What do you think about this? And that she and I are engaged together in making sure that she and her kids are safe at our visitation center. And then I want to engage with Phil to make sure that he's getting the kind of contact with his kids that he needs. My engagement with Phil is not the same as my engagement with Jill, because I'm here to protect Jill from Phil, but I'm also here to do something for Phil. Visitation centers are a service for people who have been abusive to their kids and abusive to their partners. So I'll just stop right there and let Beth take over for a little bit, unless we're going to do questions and answers now, Beth.
Yeah, no, that's what we're going to do. So
okay. If
you have a question or you want to engage in a dialogue with us, push 1 and Stephanie will come on the line and get your line unmuted. And while you're kind of organizing yourselves around getting your questions and thinking, I'm wondering if Jill and Phil can just spend just a couple of minutes talking about how that felt about that little role play we did. Phil, would you mind going first?
Sure. Well, I can see where it's really, I mean, just from this end, as the person who is, being the one going through the orientation, I can see where you want to tell your story. And, it was getting, frustrating. Like, even to me, it's just a role play, but Ellen kept bringing it back to the kids, but I wanted to talk about her. I wanted to tell my story. And it was like, well, yeah, okay, my kids love me. We'll get to that. But first, let me tell you why I've been wronged and why this is ridiculous. And so it really, for me, I was kind of locked in. And, in preparing for this, I had a bunch of kind of talking points. And I didn't even get to my talking points because it kept coming back to the kids. And I was getting frustrated.
My talking points.
my batterer talking points.
Yeah.
I had batterer talking points. What is this coming to now?
But it's funny because one thing, Phil, is I did want you to talk enough so I could get a sense of where you were at. I wanted to see how mad you were at her, how much you might put on her. I wanted to try to let you go enough, and it's interesting that you felt kind of constrained because I was trying to let you be able to talk a little bit, and so maybe I should have let you get a few more talking points out because those talking points are important for me to hear.
And I got a lot of anger in me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I had a lot more to get out, so, yeah.
Right. And so I think that's what, happens quite often, especially if you're having this form that you're feeling out or you're feeling like you have a whole bunch of questions that you need or you want a case history or a full assessment, lethality assessment, those kinds of things. Those are all things that visitation centers, as visitation centers, kind of put in the way of letting Phil get his battering talking points out, right? So when you let that go for a little bit, and, Ellen was constrained by, I gave her 4 minutes for these role plays, right? We only have 75 minutes. So there was quite a bit of constraint in that you wouldn't do this in 4 minutes or 6 minutes, that you'd have a concerted effort to put forth enough time and set aside time that you're not rushed with this process. But really what we're across is the fact that we want you to think about how you can let people guide this process and be looking for certain things and follow leads as they come to you, but don't have a preconceived notion of questions you want answered and kind of a form-like process, whether it's in your head or in front of you, that Phil won't get to his battering talking points if you guide the whole thing. Phil wouldn't get to her points either.
Yeah, and to add to that, Beth, that I'm thinking in the background, though, as Phil's talking, I have a thing in my head, not one by one, but where I think if he starts saying, she's sleeping around with all these people, that ding right away makes me think, that makes me put him in a little bit more dangerous kind of zone because he's got this idea, whether she is or isn't. But when you're sitting around in jail, you've been married to someone and you're kind of controlling. Now you're sitting around in jail and you're thinking, she's messing with this guy, she's messing with this guy. You go over there and you bash up someone's car because you think that that's the car of some guy she's sleeping with. That puts him in a fairly kind of dangerous thing because he's like when batterers start to go around and around and around in their head about her being with someone else, her taking my kids away, when they get obsessed like that, that makes them more dangerous. So you're listening for that. I was listening for that in his conversation. And it's also when he's made the decision that he's going to get those kids away from her, I wanted to eventually get to the point about what kind of a mother do you see her as being and stuff, and seeing where he's going with all of that. So I want to say that, on one hand, you don't have questions in mind. I have knowledge in my head about what makes batterers dangerous. Obsession with kids does, obsession with other lovers does, some of those kind of things. So as he's talking, he's dinging into those things. So,
Stephanie, did we have anybody who wanted to join the conversation?
At this time, there are no guests in the queue.
All right. Well, don't be shy. We're going to move on, but we don't want you to...
But now, guests, let me say this. You know, we're sitting here yakking away, and you guys are thinking something. So can't somebody just press... What do they press, operator? Star one or something?
Just one.
They press the digit one only.
Yeah, somebody press the digit one and say something, because it feels so much better on this end when we, you know, someone's out there.
For all we know, we're talking to ourselves, the four of us, and Stephanie.
Okay, yes, we do actually have a couple of questions at this time.
Oh, there we are. Thank you.
Yes, and first we do have Tracy. Your line is open.
Tracy, you should get a prize. Like, we're going to set up a little drawing now with your name in it.
Well, actually, Tracy is here, but this is Terry.
Okay,
and I just always follow Ellen's directions, and she said, somebody press the button and say something.
Good.
Well, good afternoon, Ellen.
Hi.
I don't really have a question. I was just following instructions.
Oh, very good. let me just ask you, Terry, because you're doing a lot of this. This idea of trying to get away from very rigid question and answers and open up and listening more. Can you say a little bit about that? You've been trying to do that too, right?
We have been. We don't have a formalized process of doing that just because it's so hard to frame, so it's hard to replicate.
Uh-huh.
And it, but what we, from what we have been doing, we've been trying to do this over the last about 3 years, I think, trying to engage more with the clients and build a trusting, non-judgmental relationship with them, because we learn so much more and we gain so much more cooperation. But it's really hard because it's like building on an instinct as opposed to what we have been used to with relying strictly on questions and answers.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a big transition, and it doesn't always come quickly, but we do see the more we engage with clients, the more they feel some basis of validation and trust for us, the greater the experience is for everybody all around. And truly, I think we reduce the likelihood of violence, you know, whether it is bad behavior or, you know, terrible battering. I think we reduce the likelihood of violence and anger as we do that. So, I don't know. Is that what you were looking for, Ellen?
Yeah, right, right. Yeah.
Stephanie, did somebody else chime in too?
Yes, they did. Next, we do have Sharon. Your line is open.
Hi, Sharon.
Also obeyed Ellen and Beth and pushed the button, but I guess since we're still in the beginning phases, and we have had 3 referrals, so we're just getting started. If you're doing this orientation at the very beginning, and say you've given them an intake form to fill out, and they come back with the intake form, and then you proceed into more informal discussion. You're going to carry this out to subsequent visits, if I'm correct?
I think you're trying to look at your whole process about different methods that you have to kind of engage with people as they're using your center, because when we did the evaluations of centers, a lot of people felt, especially the custodial parent oftentimes felt that they had very little contact with center staff. They dropped the kids off, they were gone, they came back, and that the visiting parent actually had more contact and the staff got to know them a little better. So a lot of people we got a lot of very positive feedback in the national evaluation of centers, but one of the, I think, kind of criticisms was that there wasn't a lot of opportunity to engage with staff about the, as issues came up, so that the biggest engagement was in that initial intake, and then people felt they had really very little contact with you all and actually wanted more.
Okay.
So check-ins and exit interviews and things like that people were looking more for. You know, sometimes check-ins after a visit, calls in between, and a lot of centers have started to have those kinds of more regular kind of check-ins with people and contacts with people, and are thus getting a lot more, not only a lot more information about their what they need from the center, but a lot more information about some of the kind of threats that are being made in between visits and out in the parking lots and things like that. So you actually end up finding out a lot more, because our knowledge is really what happens once people walk through that doorway. And most, when we evaluation showed that most of the reoffenses occurred within a mile of the visitation center on the way in and out still.
What we also found out when we talked to centers, it was becoming real apparent, and people realized as we were talking that what they knew about people's needs when they come to a visitation center and their safety needs was based way back when they had their first intake. And they didn't kind of have this way to get ongoing information. Because what we know about families who are coming to visitation centers is they're at a time of tremendous transition, and lots of stuff is happening. They're going to court, in and out. Lots of changes are happening, and lots of ways in which battering used to happen now in post-separation, it happens differently. And so once you make this concerted effort to say, you know, we're really going to be engaged in an ongoing way, not just this first appointment, but this sets the stage, and we're going to move forward with making sure we have time to talk to everybody who comes through our doors, men, women, and children. It changed a lot around what we know and how can we account for people's needs when they come through us, through the doors.
If I can use an example of what Phil just did, who's supposed to be Jack, but we're calling him Phil because his name is Phil, but what Phil just did, he's coming into the center for the first time. He's saying, look, I'm a good father, and she's done this thing to me, and I'm going to get those kids. Well, sometime in the next year or so, there is going to be some kind of a decision about the kids. If it goes against him, the danger level he poses skyrockets. If he's very, it depends, you know, you can't overly draw a conclusion from what he said here, but if he gets fixated on getting those kids and then he doesn't get them, the danger level goes way up. And if he does get those kids, you can see that his willingness to let her be with her kids is going to be pretty slim. So if she were to lose custody to him, which most people would think, well, how could she? But unfortunately, it happens a lot. But if she were to lose custody to him, that would probably be somewhat of a disaster in terms of the kids having access to their mother. But if he loses custody, that is also a very dangerous situation, because those are the times when people oftentimes strike out in a lot more violence, including, as all of us are tragically reminded of almost every month, somebody killing their kids because they're going to lose them, and or as the final kind of, you know, punishment of her. So, and it's the fear every visitation center has, but we have to lock into a guy like Phil right away, because he's telling you right from the very first time you come in and see him, I am going to get those kids, no one else is going to have those kids, da-da-da-da. So you have to watch how he changes, and if he's able, if he gets the kind of help and services, and if he does the work it takes for him to start to let go, which is that's the biggest thing that batterers can't do. We have a state legislator here, Michael Paymar, who's just interviewed a bunch of men in prison, I think 11 men in our prisons, who killed or tried to kill their wives. Not one of them felt a lot of remorse about killing her, trying to kill her. They all still, in prison, after she's dead, felt justified in trying to kill her or killing her because of what she did to them. So this idea of being wronged is so huge with batterers, and visitation centers are hearing it every day. And the biggest question to us is, in what ways do we work with men that helps them but doesn't collude with them? Because when you collude with them on this idea that they've been wronged, you feed into this thing that is extremely self-destructive and will turn against the children and the mothers in some way.
So if we had more time to go on with the role play for, you know, if Ellen had this whole 75 minutes to kind of walk through this process, what I think we'd begin to be able to see is how Ellen starts to talk to Phil and Jill about the safety about coming to the visitation center and what the visitation center can address, and then what are their needs that the visitation center can address, and do something about both of those things in an intentional way. And so first, what we would think about when we would safety plan with Jill in this conversation is, and we're not sure safety plan is the right word, but it's like the context of spending concerted time thinking about people's safety needs when they come to a visitation center. So thinking about with her, what about coming to the visitation center causes concern? Does it cause any concern? During the visit, what would be your concerns? What are you wanting us to pay attention to? And then after visits. And then in between visits, and then when you're not using services any longer, what does that look like? What does that feel like? What might that happen? All of those conversations. And so you're allowing this time to think about it and talk about it, but then you're also being responsive to it. And what I mean by that is visitation centers, we spend a whole bunch of time planning for how we design our centers. We talk about it. We fundraise for it. We put things in place that make sense for us. We have decided what doors people use, how parking lots are divided, how staggered arrival works for us. You know, all of these safety features. We've had conversations about whether we're going to have security guards or not security guards and metal detectors. And so it almost sometimes feels like we have talked about this and planned for this so much that we have a center we feel really comfortable with. What doesn't happen then is those conversations and that thinking about what's been put in place doesn't get translated to be giving to the people who come to our center. That automatic things sometimes just get put in place and we assume that now we've taken care of that. And I think it's really important to engage people in conversations about what you've thought about in order to have a safe place, but then asking, does that meet your needs? Have we thought about everything? Have some of the things that we put in place make you not safe? We can't make a lot of assumptions, and sometimes I think we work in this way that we inherently make a lot of assumptions, like staggered arrival and departure time. Whatever we have come up with the notion around that, we assume that everybody will feel like that's a good idea. And so to have a conversation about this is typically how we do it, should we think about something else for you? This is typically where you'd park, or this is where the bus stop is in relation to our center. What about that doesn't feel okay? And can we brainstorm about making this feel good? And you can throw out some options, give them an opportunity to brainstorm with you. And, you know, there's 99% of the things that you come up together, you'll probably come up with a solution that feels good for the moment. Some things you'll have to say, oh, gosh, you know, you might need to think about this a little more. I might need to see if we can get gas vouchers or a taxi to take you to and from the visitation center. Do we have money to do that? You know, those kinds of brainstormings that might take a little bit more. But most of the time on the spot, you can think about ways in which this feels safe, coming and going and during visits and then accounting for later. And when you move through that conversation and giving people and listening for things that they're concerned about, that's when you can start having those conversations. The other thing you're wanting to pay attention to is then there's going to be a whole lot of stuff that the center can meet their needs around, but then there's a whole lot of stuff that the center can't. And so that's what we mean by making meaningful linkages to advocacy and support services so that you can address and be what you do as a center, what you've determined where your role is and what you do for the family, and then help them get connected and linked up to what else happens. Then we didn't have Harry or Gracie as our role play today, but a part of what we think about when we think about orientation and intake is spending concerted time with kids. And that happens in lots of different ways for centers. Some centers have the kids come at the time that the custodial parent comes and they get to play in the center or be in the center, and some schedule separate appointments, some don't do it at all. And what we want to explore just a little bit is finding a time that is intentional time that you get to spend with kids before this all starts. So not meaning 10 minutes before the first visit, but really making an attempt to have time where kids get to feel and ask questions and know what it's like to come to the visitation center. And I think when we talk about kids, you know, I think in our visitation world, safety gets, that word gets used a lot. We use it all the time, over and over and over again. And what I think sometimes for kids is that sometimes that is their reality, sometimes that is something that they need to know, that they want addressed, that that's their primary concern about coming to see their parent, is that they want to know that they're going to be safe. They want to know, you know, they really need to know very specific things. But what I think we should do is not make assumptions that every child is going to know, need to know this at this very moment, and take the lead of the child in what they need to know to come to the center. And so when we think in our kind of our adult world of what kids will need, and we assume, you know, we know a lot all of a sudden before the kids even get there about what's happened, we might get court orders, we might get the protection order, we might get, you know, lots of information, so we start forming this picture about, oh gosh, this, you know, this is going to be really hard, these kids aren't going to want to come, there's no way they're going to want to do this, or they must be really excited, you know, so there's a lot of assumption making in our heads. And so to just put that aside for a minute and go with their lead, go with their questions that they're asking, go with what they're interested in, go with what they want to find out, and you'll get this natural progression. Instead of kind of inserting this word safety a lot, we did a couple of focus groups with kids, and one kid, he's 13, he just sticks out in my mind so much because he says, you know, you people talk about safety all the time. This is safe, that's safe, this is safe. He goes, I don't need to be safe. I'm with my dad. And he just was so clear about that. And so in his reality, showing him panic buttons and showing him that we have a security officer and showing him this and that about what we put in place for safety didn't connect with what he wanted. He really wanted to know why we had all those closed doors on the other side of the room and what was behind them. That was his biggest concern. You know, so I think just spending time thinking about what it is that kids need and having this way in which we can set up a routine with them and having a way that we have ongoing conversations, because what kids come in first and are worried about or concerned about or excited about or anxious about might not be what we think they'll be worried, anxious, excited about, or wondering about after even the first visit. So accounting for time to talk to them about how it felt. Do we need to change something? And filtering that through our adult world of how we can acknowledge that, and still consistently and constantly getting feedback from their parents. They also can inform us about how this is going for them, what they're telling them after visits. All of those kinds of pieces really need to keep coming into play.
You know, I think it's interesting, Beth, when you point out that the child is saying, why do you keep saying safety, safety, I'm with my dad? And so for some kids, they don't feel safe with their dads, but many they do, and they don't necessarily think they need to be there with their dads. They think they can go somewhere else. And so the message that they get, you're not safe with, you know, we're here to protect you from your dad, and they don't feel they need it. And he isn't the same guy as the one who's sexually abusing his kids or who's trying to get information about where she lives. I mean, there's a pretty broad spectrum of people in that center. And I think that's an interesting challenge for visitation centers. And you can see why fathers who don't pose that kind of a danger for their children get so upset at the obsession with these words and everything. I think that's a really interesting thing, and it's one of the reasons that a lot of people get mad at the centers, even ones that should be there. They aren't necessarily in that place dangerous to their children.
Right. Or in a different area of continuum, there, you know, people tell us lots of ways in which this isn't safe coming to the visitation center,
mm-hmm.
and it's not always the same. You know, coming
mm-hmm.
and going might be the issue, or I think they're going to put a tracking system in the Nintendo game that they're going to give my kid during visits. Those are two totally different ways in which we need to account for how people are safe at a visitation center. And we have to pay attention to all of those things and account for them in some way so that it doesn't get missed, because everybody can't fit in the same way in which we do things. You know, we have to be willing to be flexible and meet people where they're at and what they need. Last thing we want to talk about, you know, how we would go further with Phil in his role play. And I think what also happens as we go a little bit longer in that is that there's lots of strategies that we can do at a visitation center to engage them in a way where we decrease anxiety, we decrease frustration and nervousness, and whenever we do that, it creates a safer environment for everybody. When people come all balled up and frustrated, upset, angry, and nervous, something's going to happen. Whether it's at the visitation center or it's away from the visitation center, that level of anxiety can't just carry through with nothing happening when we're talking about batterers. So as a visitation center, we can take responsibility to do something about that. And we can help men plan for visits. We can have them more prepared and kind of aware of what's going to happen, what may or may not happen. We can help them think about what their hopes and expectations are about when they come to visits. I think many, many men come to visitation, and that first appointment that they have is what they're focused on, and we didn't give an opportunity to talk about what it'll be like the first time you come and see your kids here. And so to break that down with them, give them an opportunity to talk about what they want to do during their first visit, have them see the center, and pick up on things that they're responding to. So if they respond, my kid's not going to like anything. We are outside. We're the rough and tumble. We like to wrestle. We like to play football. This place isn't big enough. Use that opportunity to talk about, well, let's find something that we can do here. You know, when I met with Harry, these are the things that he liked to do while we were, you know, hanging out for about 20 minutes. And do you want to look at that? Do you want to learn how to play it so you know how to do it when Harry comes? You know, all those kinds of things help give ideas of how this will go. And then also I think it's really helpful to find kind of disparities. When you ask, what do you want to do at the first visit, or what do you think your child will do when they first see you, if they have expectations of having that visit go a certain way, if they say, I just can't wait to, you know, give them a big hug and miss them so much, and you've met with Harry and he said, I don't want my dad to touch me. I'm a little nervous, and can you help me do that? There's a big disparity between what Phil is going to be expecting at that first visit and what he wants to have happen versus what Harry has told you he wants. And so we need to match those two in a way that they're both, that Phil's prepared for how Harry's going to respond. And just letting it see how it goes and plays out probably isn't the best approach there when you find these disparities that are happening. And it's not going to be safe for anybody. It's not going to be successful, and it's going to increase in anxiety. It's going to increase that frustration and that anger. And it's going to put a rift in your ability to continue to engage with him in a way that will minimize his opportunity and inclination to cause further harm. And that comes and plays out in lots of different ways that we see happening in visitation centers and away from visitation centers. But anytime we can insert ourselves in minimizing that harm by engaging with him and figuring out how we make this the best that we can make it for everyone involved, we have a lot more ability to make long-term successful changes in families' lives, that they have this ability not just to think about, in these four walls, this is how I have to behave, and I'm going to put up with it because these are the rules, but it doesn't make sense in the context of my life, versus we're setting the stage for having this successful long-term. Whether they're at the visitation center or not, we have the ability to kind of make those two choices as visitation center workers. And the paths that we go down with people are kind of how we guide the process, and letting them guide the process in figuring out what they need and what they want and how we can help is one way we can make this more successful. All right.
So there it is, Beth, the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
So help me.
I wanted to kind of mention that on, I think it's October...
28th and 29th.
28th and 29th, we're going to have a two-day or a three-day?
It's a two-day.
Yeah, obviously, if it's the 28th and 29th, it's a two-day get-together with all the visitation centers that want to come. Where is it going to be, Beth?
It's going to be in St. Paul. So look for your registration. We're going to send out registration in the coming weeks here for you to start thinking about who you're going to send to the two-day institute. Your entire grant program community partners are welcome. But put it on your calendar. We sent a save the date out a few weeks ago, but it's a for sure piece that should be on everyone's calendar. Plan around it. Look forward to it.
Yeah, because it's going to be, I think we're going to do these very, we've put together these five packets called Engaged to Protect, and it's all about how to engage with, there's a whole track kind of on engaging with men and a track on engaging with women. There's I think we're going to do all five packets. We'll see if we can get them all in the agenda, and you can pick which one you want to go to. But people like you, Terry, there's a whole track on developing policies within visitation centers. So we did one packet on developing policies, one on the theory and how theory and safety come together in a visitation center, or different concepts people use. One track on engagement with men, one on engagement with women, and one on getting feedback from people through surveys and focus groups and exit interviews and check-ins. And so those five training packets are all going to be played out, I think, in this October conference. So we'd really like as many people that can to come to that, because I think it'll be some of these ideas we're trying to get across in 75 minutes here will be done in a much better way at that conference over a two-day period. You can really kind of dig into one of these five areas that we gave you. Is that the agenda is going to be around those five packets, right?
Yep, that's
Beth?
Exactly right. So,
okay.
We can spend 2 days exploring and critically thinking and challenging each other and challenging how we think this might work and how might it work better. So it's one of those great chances to do.
And if you're interested in a two-day training or a day-and-a-half training on the whole practice of orientation, email Beth, and we'll see what we get and talk to OVW about that, because we do have this 75-minute thing comes from a two-day training that we do on how to do orientations, incorporating the six principles of OVW and incorporating the full-fledged kind of how you do protection on domestic violence cases. So if you're interested in a training like that, we're just interested in how many people would be interested in going to one like that, also whether or not we should try to stick it in our October already overloaded agenda. So email Beth if you're interested in that.
Right. That'd be great. And then we're going to continue our three-part series. So next week, the same time, same channel, we're going to carry on our conversation and explore the purpose of orientation, the second one, which is building respectful and fair relationships. So that's August 13th, next Wednesday. And then August 20th, we're going to complete our series, and that will be on recognizing and meeting families' unique needs. So stay tuned for those two. Please join us. Thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate you taking the time to explore with us and think out loud with us. And despite the fact that only two of you called in, I know that many more wanted to. So, you have two more opportunities to do that. So,
and Phil and Jill, thank you very much for doing this. It was, you guys are just natural role players. I knew that we didn't have to give you any prep time at all to do this. So thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm sorry, Phil, that you didn't get all your talking points in, but I can tell you just as
it was so therapeutic. It felt so good to just load. And so, yeah, but you did a great job, and you de-escalated me.
Okay. Jill, can you talk to him and help him out now?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, thank you, everyone.
Remember
that someone or something out there probably loves you. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.